Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Pressure is growing on Hamas to accept a ceasefire that has strong US backing. A Hamas official has reportedly said the group has no major issues with the content of the new Israeli proposals. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, called on the Islamist group to accept the deal.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas.
One sticking point had been Hamas's demand for a permanent ceasefire, with Israel insisting on just a pause in the fighting. It's hoped that new wording in the deal, which calls for the restoration of sustainable calm, will provide an acceptable compromise. It's still unclear whether Hamas delegation has arrived in Cairo to deliver its response in talks with Egyptian and Qatari negotiators. Kenyan officials say at least 45 people, including 17 children, have been killed after a dam collapsed following torrential rainfall. Residents spoke of frantic efforts to pull people out of the raging flood in the dark or dig them out of the mud in Mahiu in the Rift Valley. Barbara Pladusha is in the village and has sent us this report.
I spoke to a man earlier who said when he woke up, he could hear the sound of water. He said it was sort of like a roar, and he got his family out of their house in time, but around 50 of the families where he was living lost their homes, and some of them were taken away by the floods. He said he was able to rescue one little boy. At least 45 people have been killed, and it's part of the heavy rains we've been having in Kenya and other parts of East Africa in the past month. They're continuing, so this is really quite ominous because there are other dams in other parts of the country that are filling up as well.
Scotland's First Minister, Hamza Youssef, has announced he's resigning after 13 months in office. He'd been facing no confidence votes after ending a partnership with the Scottish Green Party. Here's Lorna Gordon in Edinburgh.
Pressure had been mounting on Hamza Youssef to step down after he sacked his junior partners in government, the Scottish Greens, following a row over climate change commitments. He was facing two votes of no confidence, one in him and one in his government. Mr. Youssef insisted it would have been possible to survive them, but that he didn't want to trade his principles to hold on to power. He'll remain in post as Scotland's first minister until a successor is found.
A German soldier has admitted in court that he acted as a spy for Russia, supplying information discovered during his work in military procurement. The man, known only as Thomas H., said he had done this to prevent the war in Ukraine from escalating. He'd apparently approached the Russian embassy in Berlin, offering to help them. His arrest followed a warning from the German security services that Russia was now engaging in an aggressive espionage operation. Live from London, you're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. The Finnish carrier Finnair says it had to suspend flights to the Estonian city of Tartu because of the jamming of GPS signals used for navigation near the Russian border. The company said that under the circumstances it was impossible to guarantee safe landings. It added that GPS jamming incidents had increased markedly since the Russian attack on Ukraine in 2022. Almost all the cases are in areas within the reach of Moscow's technology. Six Greek officials have been convicted for their failures during a wildfire which killed more than 100 people. The resort of Mati was partially destroyed by the blaze in 2018. Here's Paul Moss.
There wasn't enough warning, a court in Athens was told. The rescue operation was too slow, and drivers trying to flee from Mati were directed towards areas already on fire, meaning some burned to death in their cars. Now, five officials have been found guilty of involuntary manslaughter and criminal negligence, while another was convicted of involuntary arson. But all were allowed to pay a large fine to avoid going to prison, and 15 defendants were acquitted, including all the local politicians who'd been charged. Relatives of the victims complained that justice had not been served.
The United Nations says it's alarmed by a new law in Iraq that criminalises same-sex relationships with jail terms of up to 15 years. The Iraqi government claims it will uphold Islamic values, but the UN's Human Rights Office warned the law would expose people to hate crime, police abuse, blackmail and torture. Transgender people can also be jailed. English Premier League football clubs have agreed in principle to introduce a new spending cap. A majority voted in favour of the plan, which will be determined by the amount of money earned in television rights by the lowest earning club in the league. If approved, the new model could be in place from the 2025-26 season. And that's the latest BBC News.
I feel lucky.
Wartstock is coming to Warner Park on Sunday, May 19th, and we're holding a raffle with some great prizes. Winners will take home one of five Summer Music Festival weekend passes, and we've added dinner for six with tequila tastings at Migrants, worth over $700, a pair of season passes to Forward Theater, stays from Marquette and Ruby Marie Hotels, and a crystal and onyx necklace from Goodman's Jewelers. Gift certificates from Sardine, Orange Tree Imports, 10 Pin Alleys, and much, much more. Plus, merch from Wine and Hop Shop, and of course, some great wart swag. Tickets are $3 each, 2 for 5 and 5 for 10. Drawing is at 5 p.m. at Wartstock, but you do not need to be present to win. Tickets are available at upcoming wart events or at the station. A complete list of prizes is on our website at wartfm.org. Good luck.
I feel lucky today.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth.
Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm your Monday host, Douglas Haynes. On today's show, we'll pick up our occasional focus on Wisconsin food and agriculture by taking an inside look at Top Chef Wisconsin, the 21st season of the hit reality television series. In this season's first six episodes, chefs from across the country have been challenged to showcase Wisconsin hops, cheeses, cherries, and produce from the Dane County Farmers Market. Along the way, they visited Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin, the Miller Brewery Caves in Milwaukee, Oconomowoc's Cupola Barn, and many other local landmarks. First, today, we'll talk with two of Top Chef's producers about their experiences creating the show in Wisconsin and their efforts to highlight Wisconsin culinary and cultural icons. In the second half of the show, we'll be joined by the co-owner of one of the restaurants featured in the show, Madison's Harvey House, and we'll be joined by Cap Times food editor Lindsay Christians, who has created a companion podcast about Top Chef Wisconsin. I also want to welcome all of you listening today. If you have a question for my guests or would like to share an observation about Wisconsin's culinary heritage or the new season of Top Chef, please do give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. My first guest today to talk about Top Chef Wisconsin is Diana Schmiedemann, a producer of Top Chef. Welcome to A Public Affair, Diana.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you with us. So you were one of a crew of folks from the production team for Top Chef who came out to Wisconsin in November 2022. I don't remember the weather exactly in November 2022, but November can be anything and everything here in Wisconsin. So maybe you could tell us about what that experience was like. But so you came out to visit more than 50 potential filming locations and just get an on-the-ground sense of culinary culture here in Wisconsin. We'd love to hear more about that, the background for this show, as we highlight here what you all really saw in Wisconsin and why you wanted to feature Wisconsin on Top Chef. So tell us a little bit more about this scouting trip. Tell us the story of the scouting trip, and then maybe we can talk about particular places you visited that were memorable or struck you.
Yeah, for sure. You know, our scouting trips are tough, long, you know, they seem like they're super, you know, having to go to all the restaurants and all the different tourist places, it's like a dream, right? It seems like who wouldn't want to do that? But at the same time, it's like a lot of work and you're scouting a lot of different locations. And probably because what you're hearing right now is I just got back from a 10-day scout for our next location. So my brain is a little bit dead right now. But in Wisconsin, I mean, we were able to see what was really nice to be able to get really deep into Milwaukee and discover what that city is all about. You know, I had been in Madison a bunch. As probably a lot of you know, my husband's from Wisconsin, from Madison. So I had been many, many times and gotten to see that city pretty in depth. But Milwaukee was awesome. What a thriving, amazing city Milwaukee's becoming. I mean, just from 10 years ago when I was there, or even longer, it's a whole new city. And then getting to go on the road and driving up to Kohler and driving up to Green Bay. And I mean, I'm a Packer fan, so, you know, by marriage. So that was really fun. And Door County, getting to meet all the producers up there was just fantastic, and then finishing it off in Madison. So, you know, we really focus on getting to know the state and the city as best as possible through these locations and through the people that represent those locations. So when we got to Wisconsin, like, you know, of course, like the cheese and the beer and the history and all that, that's super important. But then also we got to meet cranberry growers and cherry growers and got to hear their stories and what they're doing differently in the world these days. And that was the stuff that makes the show. And as you all know, like what makes the show really fun and really different. We got to learn about things like fish boils, which we didn't know about before. So that was like really interesting to get to experience that. And and of course, like the culture of supper clubs, like that was, I knew about it, but then getting to show all our producers like how fabulous it was.
So you went to a fish boil in Door County?
We didn't go to one, no, but sorry, we were told about one, and we saw videos and whatnot, yep, and like where they do it in this one area in Door County. So we kind of got to like envision it a little bit, but
So it sounds like sort of a whirlwind tour. Are there particular moments that stuck out, or how does the team to come together and sift through all those experiences and then say, okay, this, and this? Is it a combination of logistics and values in terms of what you want to focus on? Or do you hear stories from somebody and say, hey, that's it, we have to go there? How does it work?
Yeah, so it's kind of a combination. So obviously the destination asks us to do certain things. They want different partners to be involved. Again, back to the cranberries and the cherries, like in Door County, like they really wanted those partners to be involved. That was really, really important to them. So we take that information and we sort of create a game plan, but also based on our research and who we're meeting, you know, and sort of the way the season's going to be structured. It's a big giant puzzle. So we take all those little bits and pieces of information and we plug it into a larger, you know, master plan. So if we're going to do, you know, if we're going to do cheese one episode, we're going to make sure to cover, you know, we're not going to probably put too much Wisconsin produce, like, you know, specific things into that episode. We'll take the cherries and we'll take the cranberries and put it into another episode so they get their starring moment. And then, you know, we know that there's a certain amount of episodes that we're going to shoot in Madison. So what are we going to do there and how are we going to highlight that and what's important to that? And, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright is all over Wisconsin. So what's the best way to show that off? So it's a collaboration between the partners, the state, the network, the production company, and just, you know, all the creative.
Yeah. And you mentioned the partners, and Travel Wisconsin obviously was one of those partners here in Wisconsin. Tell us more about kind of the story of how that unfolded over time and to the point that you actually got on the ground here to do all of the things you were just describing.
Yeah. So I, again, because my husband is from the state, like he'd been, you know, saying we really need to go there, And I'm like, I get it. In due time, it'll happen. But I had sort of courted the state before and I felt like, you know, maybe it wasn't ready. Maybe it wasn't time to go there. Maybe doing like a full Midwest season. You know, there's a lot that we sort of ruminate over. And we had Travel Wisconsin reach out to us prior to pandemic to just say like, hey, is this something you'd ever be interested in? And I said, yes, 100%. Just let's put a pin in that for now, because I've got all these other destinations that I've sort of been talking to for a number of years now. You know, my work takes time. You know, we have to make sure that everything lines up and everyone's on the same page when we go. And so I said, just stand by, we'll get there. We tried to make it work. My dates are escaping me at the moment. We tried to make it work, for a previous year, but there was, I think, an issue with the RNC being there or something like that. I think the Masters, or there was some golf tournament that they were like consuming all of the rooms.
Uh-huh.
So anyways, it worked out. This was actually the time it should have happened in, and it was perfect. And it was a great season. But yes, that's how that kind of goes down.
Yeah. So did you have what you hoped would be sort of takeaways about Wisconsin food and culture that after doing all that scouting and logistics and planning that you went into the show with, saying, I hope people remember this about Wisconsin food?
My favorite thing was when I was watching some of the cuts, I remember I you know, we had met all the cheese farmers through the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and Andy Hatch and whatnot. And I remember watching some of the cuts. I reached out to Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and said, have Andy start making some cheese because that man's going to get called and he's going to have some orders. And I think it happened that way too. But that was my favorite thing is that, you know, one of my favorite things. I mean, obviously, like cheese curds is such a huge part of it, but like that is just like just one aspect of cheese in Wisconsin and getting to see all the different types of like elevated and nuanced cheeses that are coming through and getting to meet like the master cheesemaker, Pam. And I don't know, it's just so cool. It was that particular moment was really fun. We met for our first meeting when we were on our scout in Madison. We met at Jenna's, a bar in Madison, which I had
just
been
a few
to
blocks away from where I'm sitting here. Yeah.
And I had been with my husband there, you know, meeting high school friends before. And here we are with like some of the best cheesemakers in the world sitting there having cheese in the upstairs of Jenna's. And that was kind of very fun. But it was really cool to get to be able to showcase that at such a high level, you know, not just at this like fried cheese level. It was very cool.
Absolutely. And that really comes through in the shot where you have the cheesemakers come in. You have this whole spread of the huge variety of Wisconsin cheese set out there. And obviously folks who wander the farmer's market, Dane County Farmer's Market on a Saturday, will see that. But just to see it kind of concentrated in one place and obviously so visually appealing the way it was set up there on that set for the show was really, really impressive. Go ahead, Diana.
We had kind of a fun thing this past season, which I, you know, I'm hoping it came through visually, but we don't, every year our stage looks different. And this year we incorporated a cheese fridge into the stage. So that had all of, you know, Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin cheese in there, which was very fun to have. You know, so we have produce sections sometimes and like wine sections, but this time it was a cheese section. So that was cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Any personal favorites? We won't take it as advertising, just maybe types of cheese that really stand out to you.
I mean, I'm a cheddar girl. I just love cheddar. So any kind, just all day long. Yeah.
Yeah. There's plenty of that to be had here, of course.
Most definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Diana Schmiedemann. We're going to bring your colleague, T. Gwynn, here to talk about the onset production now that you've given us this background for the show. But we really appreciate you joining us. I've been talking with Diana Schmiedemann, producer, one of the producers of Top Chef. Thanks again, Diana.
Thanks so much.
And again, I'm going to introduce now T. Gwynn in a moment, but I want to remind listeners that you are listening to A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM Madison. We're talking today about the phenomenon of Top Chef Wisconsin, the 21st season of the hit reality television series. And we're talking especially about the ways that this show is highlighting Wisconsin's culinary heritage and its food and agricultural cultures. It's many food and agricultural cultures. If you have an observation about the show or a question for my guests, give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. So again, I'm going to bring in now another one of the producers of Top Chef Wisconsin, T. Gwynn, co-executive producer. Welcome to A Public Affair, T.
Hi there.
Thanks.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming on.
Of course.
Yeah, so we get your perspective here now on what it was like to work on the set here in Madison, in Milwaukee, and elsewhere. But first of all, T, it would be great for listeners just to hear a little snapshot about what a producer does on set for a show like Top Chef and what that looked like here in Wisconsin.
Of course. Well, there's multiple producers on the show. Myself, I'm the co-executive producer. So my job entails everything from, you know, scouting the locations, finding inspiration, ideating, coming up with the challenges, figuring out what locations, what kind of foods, what kind of culinary, the rules that we, you know, I mean, we do from everything from top to bottom of what you see on the show. So, you know, I deal with all the chefs as well as, you know, talking to the hosts and the judges and making sure, you know, what we, the challenges are, like what we're looking for and, you know, and getting that across But it's really exciting. You know, like, we love our job. We love the show. We love what we do. And being in a place like Wisconsin, where we always look back and say, what a great place. You guys welcomed us with open arms. And it was a really fantastic experience.
Oh, that's great to hear and great to get a sense of what that job entails. It sounds very, very busy. And I'm trying to imagine specifically you and the rest of the cast there and the chefs running around some of the places that you can see in the 21st season of Top Chef here in Wisconsin. So I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about some of those specific places and specific decisions and things you all were trying to highlight in those places. One of them, of course, is the Dane County Farmers Market, which I just mentioned, which is featured in one of the episodes of this season. What I imagine is a very hectic place on what looked like a sunny September Saturday. Maybe it was August, but I saw some color in the leaves. What was it like trying to coordinate shooting in the Dane County Farmers Market?
Well, first of all, I have to say, love the Dane County Farmers Market. Probably went there 3 times before we ended up shooting, just to get a feel of it. You know, one of the biggest things that I knew was going to be a challenge is it's one directional, right? So we couldn't cover the entire farmers market on the day of. So we kept going back to scout because we had to figure out, like, what was the best route in the limited amount of time that we had to give the chefs so they can access it and they can only go one way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just the logistics of it, but also trying to make sure that there's enough of the vendors, like, to give them enough ingredients, a variety of ingredients. And we shot on a Saturday because that's the day it's open. So we had that always scheduled and trying to figure out, what vendors are going to be there. But the direction was also, like, we mapped it out, literally mapped out everything and then said, okay, they can only go one direction. I think we gave them an L shape. At one point, I wanted to give them a U shape. We're like, okay, we can only give them 10 minutes to run around. Then they have to go up and then they have to go cook for another 30 minutes. So there's a lot of time that you start to lose as you start to map it all out. And then, you know, part of the rules too, which, you know, we don't always explain this on camera, but I think you said, look, if you want to go backwards, because that happens, right? We gave them a map. We literally made a map and said, here, we think this is where the mushroom guy is. This is where this person is. This is where the peaches are. But if you need to go back, you can't just run backwards. So it was, you have to come back out to the side of the street and kind of run back. But with 10 minutes, I think maybe one or two of them did that, but most of it was just one direction. And so that was the biggest challenge. And there was, I forget, off the top of my head, there was like 10 of them left or something like that at that point, 10 or 12. And there was a producer assigned to each chef. I took one. We each took a chef. We basically gave them the budget. We said, here's a map. And we each followed them just to make sure that they're adhering to the rules. They were, you know, they could, once you buy something, you can't return it. And we were following each chef, so we knew what they were doing, what they were purchasing. And again, they went and shopped blind. They've never been there. On top of it, they didn't even know what they were cooking. It was, here's a budget, here's $100, and just go shop and figure out what you're gonna need, because you'll find out the challenge afterwards. So it was a lot of fun, but I will say there was two runners. If you've been watching the show, there's a run club. There's several of them that run in the morning, and they're really like avid runners.
Among the chefs, you're saying, T?
Yeah, with the chefs, yeah. And so I happened to end up with Russica, who is a legit runner. And it was her, oh my gosh, it was crazy. It was just running after him. I nearly lost her like 5 different times. And it's really packed there too. So it was full. People were excited. Also felt bad that we're in their way, but it was exciting. It was a lot of excitement, but I had my running shoes on. It was a good one.
Yeah, it sounds like you would have needed them. And like, you had to do basically the legwork of what any Dane County Farmers Market visitor knows or learns over many visits, right? Over many weeks. Yeah. You had to kind of encapsulate that for the chefs to be able to navigate the market quickly, it sounds like. Tell us a little bit more about your research for the show, and I'm particularly interested in how the show highlights the culinary legacy of longtime UW-Madison head chef Carson Gully. And so the chefs had to work with some recipes from Carson Gully. Tell us how you discovered him and what you were hoping to highlight with incorporating his longtime work at UW-Madison in the show, T. Gwynn.
Yeah, you know, so Carson came about on the first scout, and it was actually Ashurana Dunning. She was on the first scout. I wasn't on that first one, but she had visited Madison, and she discovered Carson and was like, well, we need to highlight the story. And that's what we like to do, is we really like to tell these stories of, like, who makes up the culinary scene, what is, you know, the culture, how it all came about. And it's not always just who the big names are, but it's also who are these, you know, I mean, Carson's known there, but not beyond, I would say. And so, and he was such a prominent figure, and what he did, I mean, what him and his wife just did was just incredible. And so she was very inspired by that. So when we were in the development process of going back and going, okay, let's come up with all the ideas, Carson was always on our brains. Like, we found, you know, we wanted to develop a challenge that was special. And we had gone through, you always go through different ideas, like it literally goes through like 5-10 different ideas of one thing. But we made sure that was something that was really important to highlight in the story. And we actually got the recipe book, his cookbook. We looked through it, we sifted through it, and it was, you know, trying to find a spin on it. And there's, you know, quite a few recipes, and I remember still looking through all of them going, okay, this one works. This one seems too easy for the chefs. This one maybe they never heard of, but also what's different? What kind of different dishes that can they make, and how different is each recipe from the other, so that, like, no two chefs are getting the same thing. So it was born out of we discover these things as we are meeting as tourism is taking us through the first time of meeting with the different cities. And we always say, you never know what kind of nugget we will latch onto. It doesn't matter how small or big it is. It's an idea will get born out of it. And and that's how we ideate, and that's how magic happens. So that was something that we found that was really important. We were really inspired.
It was the sauces, if I remember correctly, that you ended up pulling from Carson Gulley's cookbook, right?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. So, and everybody had to sort of follow the recipes to a T of this longtime UW-Madison cook's sauces, and then they added dishes to the sauces or that fit the sauces, right?
Correct. Yeah. So they shopped at Farmer's Market with like $100 budget. Then when they got up there, they realized, okay, we've got to create a dish using one of Carson's recipes. So they all grabbed a recipe card, and then the recipe card, we actually had the ingredients for those recipes to match, and that's what you would get assigned. And then I think the only thing we had to also give them a pantry of some stuff, just limited, we always call it a limited pantry. It's really like proteins and things like that they couldn't get at the farmer's market, or if you could even get it, you're not gonna have time to defrost.
Yeah.
Like beef or chicken or anything. So things like that we had to support. And then they had to incorporate whatever they purchased as well. So it was a fun one. And I think it was a good nod to, it was a great nod to Carson in his work.
Yeah, it was, in a wonderful way to sort of bring onto the show foods that generations of UW-Madison students would have been exposed to or eaten, and connect to that history of culinary heritage in this community. So one other way that you connected with heritage in this community, obviously, is through Frank Lloyd Wright, as Diana mentioned earlier. And these are really dramatic settings that you brought the audience to for shooting TV. So that's one good reason to highlight them, right? But tell us some more about the choices to highlight Wright's buildings, both at Taliesin, but also really influential for a lot of the chefs, I think, was visiting one of the communities blocks that Wright created in Milwaukee. Tell us a little bit more about how you intentionally went about incorporating the heritage of Frank Lloyd Wright into the show.
Well, yes, there's the Frank Lloyd Wright Trail. So we discovered that. And, you know, there's quite a few properties along the trail. But we started off in Milwaukee and then made our way to Madison. And actually, this is shot over 3 days, the episode. And Burnham Block is the housing. It was like affordable housing that he built in Milwaukee. So we started our first day there. where they got inspired. I mean, they took a tour. And then from there, day two, we were like, okay, again, we were trying to fit everything in as much as possible. And it's a lot. I mean, we started off with, we'll say about 3 locations, but it really became up to 6. And this is how it was. First day is Burnham Block. You've already got that time. And the second day, we went to Monona Terrace. We also went to First Unitarian Meeting Society, which was a church that he built that his parents founded. And that actually got cut out of the show just because there was just so much that you can only fit. And that's already 3. And then we went to Taliesin, so that was 4. But within Taliesin, there is 3 locations we went in there. It was his restaurant, his first and only restaurant. Then they went to his home. And then we went to the drafting room where they were, that's where they could, they ideated and came up and had time to come up with their ideas. So all in all, that's like 4 locations, but within Taliesin 3. So it's like 6 locations over a span of like 2 days. And then they went and shopped at Whole Foods. So we wanted to fit in as much as possible just because we found things so inspirational. And the challenge itself, like at first, you know, again, as I mentioned, the challenges change all the time. So at first we were like, this is going to be an individual challenge and they were going to be inspired by his works. And it was going to have very specific things like you needed to have a certain height and structure to your dish and making it up like, you know, it has to reach a foot tall or something like that. But then as it morphed into what it became a team challenge, duos, or pairs together. And then, you know, we noticed the theme of duality that really that Wright incorporated. So we end up taking out the whole like structure of like it has to be so specific because it starts to become too many criteria. And that is how we landed on, okay, it's going to be a theme of duality, it's going to be pairs, but they're going to all these locations and they can take inspiration from wherever. But I will say Burnham Block really resonated with a lot of these chefs. And we don't know, like for us, we're like, oh, look at the structure, look at the lines, look at the, you know, compress and release. And they take it and they take it in all different directions and they relate back to their own lives and their own personal stories. And, you know, you see these different themes. And that's what's really interesting, especially on a challenge like this, because it's not food, right? It's art. And then how do you translate that into food? And everyone has a different interpretation. And I think that's what's so fun. It's so interesting to see is how creative these chefs get and how do they translate that to a plate? So that for us is super exciting because we can say, hey, look at the lines, look at this. And then they come up with something completely different.
Absolutely, T. I appreciate the depth which you just explained that. The ways that concept of duality in Frank Lloyd's architecture was manifested were so varied and so interesting. And as you said, connected to the chef's own stories, it was a really rich mm-hmm. moment of the series and a rich way to incorporate something that's important not only here in Wisconsin, but internationally, this architectural heritage of Frank Lloyd Wright. So yeah, thanks for taking the time to tell us about that. I'm going to real quick, before we let you go, T, have you transition us, segue us a little bit into talking about supper clubs. And we have the co-owner of the supper club featured in this Top Chef Wisconsin series here in the studio with us, and we'll be moving to her and Lindsay Christians from the Cap Times in a minute. But tell us about your connection with the Harvey House as the venue you decided to feature Wisconsin supper clubs in, and what jumped out at you at the Harvey House?
Well, I mean, Harvey House is just a beautiful, beautiful venue. I mean, you step in, you're like, okay, this is a converted train station, and it's just gorgeous, right? But on top of it, like we met with the owners and the chefs, and they were just wonderful people. And you're gonna have her on the show, so I would love to say hi. But yeah, this is another location. I think I went 3 times before we end up shooting there, and it was trying the food, meeting the chefs, seeing the space. Supper clubs is something we did a ton of research on, and I know that there's other supper clubs that a lot of the locals are like, why didn't you shoot there? Why don't you go here? And there's a lot of factors. It's like, if we could, we would love to shoot everywhere. And we were toying with the idea of like, okay, maybe we can take them to this one for inspiration, but then still do the service and stuff at Harvey House. But it just ended up being for just you know, with creative and with time and with the dishes too. We were trying to make sure that we honored, like, okay, we're going to do there, this is what a typical traditional supper club is. Some places didn't serve this one dish, this one didn't serve the other one, but they were able to work with us to say, okay, we'll create dishes to make sure that it follows the traditional supper club, and we're going to show you our spin on it too. And that's, they were so collaborative. And it just, that's how it ended up working out with them. But the food is just fantastic. I was literally looking at pictures the other day of the food that the chefs got to eat. And then they gave me a little bit to take home. And I was like, oh, look at that. It was just delicious. But it was just wonderful. And it was just a beautiful location. But everything about it, it fell into place. And as much as we wanted to incorporate every single supper club, it's just it didn't unfortunately work out because we don't have this time, and we spent a lot of time working with the Frank Lloyd episode going to 5 million locations. So you got to pick and choose your battles at some point.
Sure. Well, thanks for giving us some insight into your experience as a producer and the choices and what you were choosing to highlight in particular about Wisconsin culinary culture and more broadly speaking, architectural culture and so much of the history you got into in the show as well. So thanks for joining us.
Can I give one quick shout out to Tori over at L'Etoile?
Sure.
So chef owner over there, he helped us so immensely. I just remembered he helped us immensely. He took us around the farmer's market. We shot above on the rooftop for there, but I almost called him like our mini producer because he just gave us so much insight to Madison. So we just wanted to give a shout out to Tori.
Absolutely. long time kind of chef celebrity. And not only that, but somebody who's really done a lot to build local culture here in Madison. So yeah, thanks for that shout out. And thank you again for T for coming on. T. Gwynn, co-executive producer with Top Chef. Take care, T.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM. My name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today about Top Chef Wisconsin and Wisconsin's culinary heritage with a suite of guests. We've had a couple of producers from Top Chef with us via live stream, but we have fortunately a couple guests in the studio now to wrap out the show for the second half of the show. But I want to remind you, you can join the conversation if you have questions for my guests or would like to share an observation about Wisconsin's culinary heritage or the new season of Top Chef. Give us a call at 608-256-2001 extension 9. So I'm going to introduce these in studio guests now. We have with us Shayna Popich, creative director and co-owner of the Harvey House. Welcome to A Public Affair, Shayna.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we also are lucky to have with us Lindsay Christians, food editor from the Capital Times.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming in. It's always great to have live guests in the studio. So I think we'll pick up right where we left off, Shayna, with the Harvey House. And just tell us a little bit about the restaurant's history for people who may not be familiar with it, and the community's reaction since you opened there in the old train station on West Wash, just down the road here.
Sure. My husband and I opened the Harvey House in July 2021. I'm from Madison and had been away for about 20 years, and then we moved back just after having our first son, and now have three small children, and so wanted to be close to family and love Madison and the culinary culture and community here. So we opened Harvey House a few years ago. We originally wanted to open something that was a little bit more California in style. That's where we came from most recently. And once we started eating around Wisconsin, particularly at supper clubs, got extremely inspired by supper clubs and the culture around them, and decided to take some inspiration from the supper clubs that we were loving, and started to form the Harvey House.
Yeah, great. And then your encounters with Top Chef, how did that come about? How did the collaboration develop?
Yeah, well, they came in to dine. We did not know who they were. And so we do a little bit of research about our guests that come in. And so we did know that they were some type of food media. Didn't get much more information than that for quite a while. I think they were scouting all of Wisconsin and Madison. They were here in Madison to check out some restaurants. They came again and again and again. So they came many times over the past year and a half or so. And over the course of that time, they started to divulge a little bit more of what they were doing. Obviously, we couldn't share any of that with anybody. Lots of NDAs were signed at different points. And then eventually they decided to use the Harvey House. But it was a very organic process that we did not have much control over. So,
But it sounds like it took a while really for it to happen, but which was probably nice because you got to know folks along the way a little
Absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely. Their team is incredibly generous and lovely, and we really enjoyed getting to know all of them.
We're going to stay with you for one moment, Shane, and then we'll move over to Lindsay Christians. Tell us a little bit about filming in the restaurant, how your staff reacted in particular, and how they were integrated into the show.
Many of our staff are very avid Top Chef watchers, so that was very fun to be able to have, once we eventually were able to tell them that it was going to be filmed at Harvey House. So that was great. During the actual filming of the show, there was not a lot of staff that were there except for serving staff, service staff. And our kitchen team, we tried to invite as many of them to dine as we could. We didn't have a lot of invitations, so it was really just my parents and my brother and a few of our management staff from Harvey House. But, you know, they helped us with getting the restaurant camera ready in every way, which was incredible. And then it's been a really fun morale boosting opportunity to watch the show all together, both at a viewing party that Lindsay threw, and then other people had viewing parties. And, you know, many people, because of the streaming, it's kind of trickled in. So, you know, yep. Even as recent as this morning, I got a note from a team member that was on the show with us who was very excited.
Great. And is there a takeaway nugget that you hope viewers will take away from the show about Wisconsin Supper Club culture in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think just the generosity of Wisconsin is something that I always come back to, particularly with supper clubs, and how, you know, dining here is very different than dining in New York. I mean, our service staff is incredibly warm and giving and sort of takes an extra step, I would say, versus some other big city markets. And I do think that there's something very special about Midwestern hospitality that does showcase well in supper clubs particularly, but in all restaurants here in Madison, especially, and in all of Wisconsin.
Yeah. We're going to bring in Lindsay Christians, food editor with the Capital Times here as well, and kind of expand the scope of the conversation. But by all means, you two feel free to converse back and forth and jump in if you'd like, Shana. So you're a longtime observer of Wisconsin food culture, Lindsay. Tell us your take on Top Chef's representation of the state's culinary culture. Does it provide a good window into what's happening here in Madison and beyond right now?
Well, first of all, I think we look really beautiful. I've been talking a lot about the B-roll of Madison and Milwaukee, just these beautiful like drone shots coming into the city. And it kind of made my heart swell the first time I saw it. I thought, oh my God, it's so beautiful, right? It's just gorgeous. I think that Top Chef has a lot to do in a little time. So there were locations, for example, that I know that they scouted for that Taliesin challenge that the chefs went to that never made it on camera, right? And there was so much, you know, I was lucky enough to be a diner during the Supper Club challenge, and there is so much that they're gathering that it never makes it on screen, right? The quick fire challenge that morning at the roof of L'Etoile, every time they're doing, you know, a recording of the intro or the outro or, you know, telling them about the challenge, there's so much more than they can ever really show. But I have to say, I do think Wisconsin is showing really beautifully. And one of my favorite moments in that Supper Club episode was, you know, during the farmers market challenge, the people down below who were walking around the market could hear when the challenge was over, and everybody just screamed. Like, as soon as the timer went off, we were all watching down and they were looking up and we're all recording each other and clapping and yelling. And it was just this lovely moment that I think represents how excited many people in Wisconsin were and are to have the show here, because it is just, you know, it's like 10, 12 episodes just showcasing how gorgeous Wisconsin is, but also just this ability to kind of participate in it as well, and to just be kind of a part of the excitement and a part of this great showcase of what Wisconsin looks like, you know?
So it sounds like, to build on what Shana was just talking about, it created or extended the community that's already here in a sense around food and culinary culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing already the Top Chef effect. There was just a story, I think, in the State Journal about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese and how many orders they're getting now. It's like thousands. The attention that this brings to the state and to the culinary history and diversity in the state, I think, is really wonderful.
You mentioned diversity, Lindsay. Like you said, there are limitations to what you can present in this kind of form. But are there aspects of the state's culinary diversity that if they were going to do Top Chef Wisconsin 2, that you would really love to see more showcased?
I think we're going to see some more. So we have all seen the trailer. We know there's a fish boil to come, right? A Door County fish boil style fish boil. We know, obviously, that there's a sausage challenge. I saw some indigenous chefs in an episode. Elena Terry, who is a Ho-Chunk chef and really wonderful from Wild Berries, she's going to be on an episode. She was one of the judges, it looks like. So I think there is more that we haven't yet seen. Obviously, the cranberry growers were a sponsor of the season. So we're going to see a cranberry challenge. I do think, like, speaking as a Wisconsinite and someone who loves the food scene here, sometimes it feels like I want more. Like with the hops challenge, for example, we get like 3 seconds of hops, and similar kind of thing with, like, there was a Door County cherry challenge, and we got like 30 seconds maybe of Door County. And I think a lot of us would have liked to see more, and I think we will see some more. So they're trying to do a lot in a little time, you know?
And it's a very much a multi-ethnic food scene now, right? And you mentioned indigenous chefs. What are some ways that you think more ethnicities could be pulled into the picture of Wisconsin food? Or maybe does it prompt us to think about how we have this one-dimensional kind of historic view of Wisconsin food culture, very Eurocentric? And does it help us think about, well, what's actually happening now?
I mean, I guess I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I think that we have a very wide understanding of Wisconsin's food history and the culinary culture here. So I think that has been changing and is changing. I think it's really interesting to see how the chef contestants themselves are bringing their own backgrounds in. So we have some chefs who are from Mexico. We have some chefs who have, you know, diverse Asian backgrounds.
A Haitian chef.
Yes, right. Charlie, right? But also I ran into Kenny, who is a chef who has actually already been eliminated. But Kenny he was in Philadelphia and then he was coming from Atlanta. But he cooks food. He has some Vietnamese background. And one of the questions I had for him was it challenging to cook your food, the food that you want to cook, like Southern food, Philadelphia food, Vietnamese background, you know, all these different things that he's got going on. And I said, you know, was it hard to find the ingredients that you wanted here? And he said, not really. Sometimes he would have to make substitutions, but that is part of the challenge. But I think one of the things that Top Chef really encourages in the contestants is they want to see a little bit of them on the plate. They want to see a little bit of who they are and their own culinary history and background. And I think Wisconsin has all the space and more for that.
You're listening to A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM. My name is Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today about Top Chef Wisconsin and Wisconsin's culinary heritages. If you have a question for my guests in the studio right now, Lindsay Christian, food editor with the Capital Times, and Shayna Popick, creative director, co-owner of the Harvey House, there's still time to give us a call. The number is 608-256-2001, extension 9. Let's talk a little bit, and this is something that you both got to observe, about the way food and the creation of food comes across on the screen. What did you observe or learn from being kind of firsthand observers of this process about representing the colorful, sensual experience of food on the screen and what the challenges of that are, and also the creation of food? I don't know, Shayna, is that something, as somebody who's in the restaurant business, you'd like to
chime
in on?
Sure. I think as Lindsay touched to a little bit, it's a very challenging thing to do, to be on Top Chef and create something that's beautiful and delicious in such a short amount of time in a kitchen that you don't know, with, you know, equipment that you aren't used to using, all of the things that go along with that. So I think, you know, that was something that was really impressive to me to watch in the contestants, that even if things didn't come out exactly how they had expected them to, just sort of the pure effort of doing it was really impressive. And the running around, and our kitchen has 2 floors, so there was definitely some stairs that people were running up and down at different parts. I think that piece of it was interesting. And then tasting through the dishes with the judges was incredibly interesting as well. And then also seeing the show afterwards and seeing what they decided to use and not use, and sort of how everything looked based, you know, versus how it looked when we were sitting with it, I thought was an interesting And primarily, I felt like they really got the essence of what was said and what was shown, which I also thought was very impressive, to be able to cut together hours and hours and hours of time and really showcase what was happening during the actual, you know, the actual time.
Yeah. Lindsay?
So I had the opportunity to be a dishwasher during the Taliesin Challenge. So I was literally in the dish pit while all of the chefs are running around and there are cameras everywhere and they're it's a kind of a frantic atmosphere. And I noticed a couple of things. One is that I really felt like the two chefs who had, they were all staggered because they were in pairs. It was a pairs challenge, right? And so Rasika and Danny were the first chefs in the kitchen at 8:25. And then there was like a 20 or 30 minute like staggered entry for each of the chefs to come after that, each of the groups. And it really struck me that those first two had an advantage because the whole kitchen was clean. And in the spirit of like full disclosure, the Taliesin kitchen is not designed for what they wanted to do. It's just, it's not made for it. The garbage disposal in our own like dish pit failed almost immediately. Like it's designed for a home kitchen, right? So it's not up to like the beautiful Harvey House kitchen is much more contemporary. It has more, you know, of the tools that the chefs want and need. So, but those first two chefs, everything is clean, everything is where it goes. As the chefs came in group by group, they're running back to us. They're trying to find if we have any ladles. We don't have any ladles. They're trying to get the quarter sheet pans. We didn't have enough of those. Like everybody was using Vitamixes like multiple times. The blenders and the chinois were like in just full use, right? And just like again and again and again and again, right? So I think there are a lot of things like that that are going on kind of behind the scenes in terms of trying to make these beautiful plates of food, which then after they make them all, they have one that goes to a very specific setup where they can take a really beautiful photos. And there's like a little thing underneath it that rotates so you can see all the aspects of the beautiful plate of food. Those, having it look beautiful for us on screen and like their ability to execute it, that their clock doesn't stop. Like ever, people could fall, like things could happen, like someone could steal the pea puree and like it's not going to stop. So I think keeping that in mind and just understanding the immense amount of pressure that these chefs are under, these chefs who have given 6-8 weeks of their lives away from their families, away from their jobs. It's just, I think Tori Miller called it a meat grinder. It's a lot of work. And I think what's amazing about Top Chef is just how the show has evolved to really respect that work and to really, I think, drive home. This is really difficult to do, and they are operating at such a high level.
It sounds like such a constant improvisation really unfolding before your eyes, but which you wouldn't necessarily know from watching the show, right? Because it seems so well scripted and relatively calm and, you know, but yeah, that's interesting to get that insight. Lindsay, I wanted to follow up with you. You've obviously been involved in this process from early on, and you decided to devote a podcast, your podcast, The Corner Table, to this show, Top Chef Wisconsin, for a number of episodes anyway, right? Tell us about that choice and what you're trying to highlight there in the podcast.
Sure. So when I found out that Top Chef was coming last summer, it was a really exciting moment. I'm a huge Top Chef fan, and I have, you know, watched all of the seasons previous to this one. So I knew I had a lot to say, but I also, the thing that I love about being a food journalist and a journalist in general is that I get to ask a lot of questions to people who have interesting answers to them. So that's the most wonderful part of my job. So I thought this is an opportunity as Wisconsin is sort of on this national stage in a really unique way. We don't have a lot of TV in Wisconsin, right? That this is an opportunity to sort of dig in, to look behind the scenes. I was able to go behind the scenes, I think, 6 different times. And I also filed records requests with the state to see, you know, what kind of deals they made. $1.3 million went into bringing this show here. And what are we as Wisconsin going to see out of that? You know, what are the Top Chef effects going to be? Tourism is doing a lot around like sort of collaborative promotion around this and really highlighting Wisconsin culinary, coming up with culinary trails and events and things that tourists can do. But the thing is, when a show like Top Chef films here, people see it and they think about sending their kids to college here. They think about moving here. They think about, you know, taking their next vacation to Door County or to Milwaukee. We're also on this huge political stage, right? There's so much happening here. I think, didn't the draft just happen? It's a sports thing, but I think, didn't we just have the draft, right? It's just a lot is happening here. And I think Top Chef is one part of that. And so I wanted to use the perspective that I had to sort of expand and go deeper into it with some of the people who were involved. So on the podcast this week, we have Paul Bartolotta, who is a Milwaukee restaurateur. I am going to have Dan Jacobs on the show.
Tell us more about Dan Jacobs for folks who don't know about him.
Oh, Dan Jacobs is the first, like, professionally working Wisconsin chef to ever be on the show in 21 seasons. He tried, like, auditioned for the show for many years, he said, and this was finally his year. He's killing it. He's doing great. He just reopened Esther Ave with his business partner, Dan Van Wright, in Bayview. I went last Thursday. It's gorgeous, and the food is impeccable. But Dan is our Wisconsin guy. He's our hometown boy from Milwaukee. He's competing on the show this season, and he's still in it. He's doing really well. So, but I think, you know, going with the podcast and just being able to get some of that behind-the-scenes stuff, I am talking with the chef from Brewers Culinary for this coming week, because we got a little sneak peek where they're going to be doing a sausage challenge at American Family Field this week. So I'm talking to somebody from the Brewers Culinary. So it's been really fun to kind of go behind the scenes and to find out more about how these things came to be.
Yeah, it sounds like the show and focusing on the show has been a great jumping off point for you generally, just to kind of further deepen your knowledge of the state's culinary culture.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Shayna, so Lindsay was just talking about the state's investment in the show, essentially. We can call it that, right? This $1.3 million, you said, right? Through WEDIC, right?
So some of that's through WEDIC, and some of it is through, like, tourism boards. Right. So Visit Milwaukee, Destination Madison, Travel Wisconsin. Okay. Did not actually put any money in, but helped coordinate all of that.
Sure. So as a business owner, and somebody who I'm sure knows many other business owners, is that an investment that you feel like benefits many people here in Wisconsin, that that are you seeing sort of tangible outcomes already, or do you anticipate seeing outcomes of those investments kind of bearing fruit?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I think our restaurant has been significantly busier on nights that we are not traditionally as busy since the show aired. We got some beautiful, I mean, they shot the restaurant so beautifully, and they did continue to show the sign of Harvey House many times, which we were not expecting, and was such an incredible surprise. So yes, it has directly been affecting us at Harvey House. We also have a restaurant, Butterbird, and people have definitely been coming in there wondering about, you know, the relationship to Harvey House and being excited to you know, try another restaurant that we own. And in terms of Madison and Wisconsin as a whole, from a business owner's perspective, it's huge. I mean, as Lindsay was saying, people look at things differently once you look at them on TV. I was not aware of how many people watch Top Chef. I mean, people have been coming out of the woodwork, old friends who are excited to come back to Madison and try the restaurant, or, you know, people who were regulars at the beginning and kind of, you know, stopped coming as much because of this or that and have definitely been revisiting the restaurant since the showing. And then also, I've been really surprised a lot of people have been applying to work at the restaurant, which has been an incredible surprise as well. But all sorts of different things that are, you know, that are wonderful about having your restaurant, your state on a show that people respect and love so much. I mean, people are coming out.
Yeah, I'm sure, especially as a Madisonian originally yourself, and coming back and investing in this place to see that outcome, I'm guessing is gratifying.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in, both of you. I'm sad we're out of time here, but that's the way it goes.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
it would be
great to talk more, but there will be occasion after the season ends, of course, to talk more about the show and Wisconsin food and agriculture and all that goes with it. I've been talking today here with Shayna Papik, co-owner and creative director of the Harvey House in Madison, and also Lindsay Christians, food editor of the Capital Times, and also creator of the Corner Table podcast. And you've been listening to A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM. My name is Douglas Haynes. Thank you for listening. Also, thank you to our staff here at WRT. Engineer Andrew Thomas today, producer Jade Isiri Ramos, news director Shali Pittman, and today's receptionist, Ricky. If you have appreciated today's show, please share it using the Wart Online Archive or wherever you find your podcasts. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Book Beat. Up next, we have Stu Leviton in conversation with UW Professor Francine Hirsch about her book, Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg.
Will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. Pressure is growing on Hamas to accept what the US has described as a generous ceasefire deal. It's hoped the new proposals, already approved by Israel, could finally lead to a breakthrough. Here's our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson.
After many months of fractured talks, mediated by Qatar, Egypt and the US, hopes are high. Hamas has long demanded an end to the fighting, Israel only a pause. Now there's compromise, with talk of the restoration of sustainable calm and at least a 40-day ceasefire. Israel has slightly lowered the number of hostages Hamas must release in exchange for Palestinian prisoners in Israel. And many displaced Palestinians in southern Gaza would be allowed to return to their homes in the north, a key Hamas demand.
Washington has appealed to the United Arab Emirates, among other countries, to stop providing support to the warring parties in Sudan. The US ambassador to the UN said the Sudanese army and the rival RSF paramilitaries were both receiving support, which was leading to the destruction of Sudan and the displacement of millions. Kenyan officials say at least 50 people, including many children,